This is the May 21 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Kurt Kimmel. He's at agmarket.net, along with Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing. And we're joined, too, today by Colin Waters at the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at WILLAG.org. Our theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Let's begin our conversation this way. Let's get a list of kind of items that we might want to take up. Dave, I'll start with you.
Yeah, Todd. I mean, I think right now three main drivers in our commodity trade, and normally this time of year we'd be talking about weather, but I think weather brings up the rear here in this situation in terms of weather, crop conditions, playing progress, acreage switching. Certainly, we're talking about what's going on in Iran, and particularly the Strait of Hormuz, and when and if it will open, and what that will look like in terms of transport and fertilizer. But the most important thing, I think, on the docket right now is China and the coming forward of this additional potential $17 billion in non-soybean U.S. ag purchases. Really has the potential, anyway, to materially affect the balance sheets, you know, going forward. It's not a given, it's not a certainty, but I think we have to factor that in terms of pricing and how we market and how we look at marketing opportunities.
So, Kirk Kimmel, weather, the $17 billion potential in Chinese purchases, what else?
Well, I think the year of the horse, we're in a 60-year cycle with that, so that's on the back burner. Also, too, the technical picture here is quite interesting. And, of course, as Dave mentioned, weather.
I was thinking the year of the horse, we might get to the technical picture and see what that is looks like. Could be a buck-you-off kind of thing, or could be let's ride them fast and furious. And Colin Waters, from Illinois Corn Growers Association's perspective, we probably need to talk about E15 at some point, but what else?
Well, I guess there's some other policy issues apart from fuels. Like was mentioned, the trade picture right now, USDA's got a pretty significant, 3.3 billion bushel corn export forecast. I'm not sure. I don't know. That might be a little bit optimistic, but it all depends on what's happening in Brazil too. Things have been slow down there, so there's a lot of things that could be potentially moving the market here in the next couple months.
Well, I think I'd like to have you lay out this demand picture for me, both on ethanol usage in the United States, what it looks like. We could get to the policies later, but what demand looks like as it's related to ethanol, what demand looks like from your perspective from those exports, for old crop, new crop as well, and then any other things in the livestock sector, if there are some.
Right. So, in terms of ethanol, right now the domestic demand is plateaued to falling. So any movement on E15 could be beneficial, but I'm not sure. You certainly wouldn't see a 50% increase in corn demand or anything like that from domestic ethanol demand. In the last few years, most of that demand increases on the ethanol side have been in exports. So really big program into Canada, Europe, parts of Asia. So that's been significant. And a lot of those markets are really interested in, your carbon score, your carbon intensity scores. So that's a whole other policy issue too. Let's see, some other, other demand. Obviously, the beef herd is rebounding. Hopefully, avian influenza is still an issue. So there's some headwinds on the feed side and domestic side. So
let me follow up just a bit with you as it's related to demand for ethanol. A couple of things. You said plateau or falling, and really you meant incrementally with number of miles driven in the United States, because they have continued to go down. We will face some headwinds as it's related to the price of gasoline this summer. I kind of want to talk about that. But I want to discuss the export market with Canada, because the USMCA is up for discussion right now. And I think that will have a big impact on the ethanol market, potentially. Am I right or wrong about that?
No, that's true. So, you know, the Canadians are by far the largest ethanol export market right now. And that's been a really big deal, honestly. With USMCA, the other piece is Mexico for grain, right? So Mexico is taken up like a third to maybe 40% of the of corn exports over the last couple of years. So it's massive. It's absolutely huge. So the negotiations that are happening and the review that's underway for USMCA, it's really, really important and something that we're following pretty closely. I am slightly concerned that there's some folks that are looking for more significant changes in the USMCA. So we'll have to see how that all shakes out. But I'd say in aggregate, the agriculture industry has been very, very supportive. And that's kind of across the board. It's not just corn. Even the dairy guys are supportive. They've got concerns. They want some things fixed, but they're supportive of the agreement. So hopefully we can get past the review and get this extended. But I mean, even if that doesn't happen, we'll basically go back to kind of an annual review period, which is not ideal.
Dave, let's stay with corn, the export market, but draw in the $17 billion worth of agricultural products that the Chinese, take that back, that the United States says the Chinese have agreed to at this point. It could be corn, could be soybeans, could be beef. What do you think will happen?
Yeah, Todd, it's a really interesting question. It's a topic of hot debate in the market right now. And to Kurt's point of the year of the horse, if we're talking about corn demand at this particular point, it's the thoroughbred that's winning the Kentucky Derby right now. I mean, export sales this week were a 17-week high, very unusual for this time of the year. We're well on our way to realizing that record USDA demand, the $3.3 billion that was mentioned. And if you throw in on top of that the potential business for China, as we understand it today, and the details are sparse, but as we understand it, these are non-soybean purchases. So the $17 billion is set aside for grains, meats, horticulture, you know, whatever you can come up with. If you historically go back and look at that type of spending from China, if you take, you know, roughly $12 billion in what they've committed to in terms of the soybeans and the 25 million metric tons for this crop year, and you add in the $12 billion, you're talking about $28 to $30 billion in spending. And that rivals what we saw during the phase one agreement, 2020, 2021, et cetera. And we haven't seen that in a while, but in any way, shape or form for them to accomplish getting at or even close to that $17 billion figure, they're going to have to buy corn. There's just not enough other, you know, small feed grains and other ways to get to that number. And as we push the pencil to it, and assuming that, you know, the tariffs are lowered and the market opens up to the private buyers, there's a number of TRQs still available for the year. Up to 8 million metric tons right there. We're talking probably potentially 300, 500, even 600 million bushels of additional corn export demand from that China deal. Now that's potential. Okay. If that comes to fruition, you take your carry out and you certainly shift demand to some other, non-traditional U.S. Importers, and shift it to South America, but you probably end up with a U.S. balance sheet in corn with ending stocks, I don't know, 1.7 billion bushel, give or take. And that may not be enough to propel us, you know, much north of $5 in corn. But what it does do, Todd, I think, is severely resets the tolerance level that we have for any kind of a yield decline potential in the U.S. this summer during the growing season.
So, Kurt Kimmel, you said it's the year of the horse. It's a chance to talk about what the charts are going to look like. North of $5. Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, basically, just a lot of volatility in the marketplace. When you went home last Thursday, Friday, the funds were on the sell mode. They sold 50,000 contracts of corn. They come back in the first part of this week here and buy it all back. for the most part. But what you got to do when you look at the charts, draw some trend lines and some channels. It's just basically up at the upper end of the channel, down at the lower end of the channel. So a word of caution here as we move forward, if it breaks out to the downside below that channel line, I think the funds, if they're heavily technically orientated, will be on the sell side. So we're getting to a point where there is some risk psychological-wise. $5 is kind of a benchmark. In order to keep moving higher here and pop out the upper end of that channel, we need to get on above this 505, 510 area, and that kind of opens the door. But the year of the horse, we had 60 years ago, if you look at that cycle, we had some strength into the early part of the growing season. The market turned down and went lower, did not just go sharply, sharply higher. So we're at levels here, was at some levels here that everybody wished, hoped they should have, could have, would have. So you don't want to pass that away.
Now, on that December contract, and I'll ask the two of you this same question, producers probably have been told to be 35-40% sold in that range. If they are, and we have a breakout, which is likely to come now sometime in June or July, if it came earlier, maybe there's more that you might be willing to risk. But how much more would you think they should be able to add to their positions on cash sales and or covered sales through some kind of paper trade?
Yeah, Todd, I mean, we have producers upwards of 50% sold, so call it anywhere between 30 and 50, which is certainly ahead of the last number of years in terms of the amount of new crop sold at this point in the crop year. We're going to tap the brakes here just a little bit, and to Kurt's point, and see if we can't get that breakout and see if we can't get it to the upside. I think the whole Chinese development, I'll call it, or the announcement of by the White House of this potential additional buying by China, effectively acts as a little bit of a put underneath the market, at least in the short term. So it buys us a little bit of time to see what happens with the agreement, what happens with weather and crop yield. And as I mentioned, I mean, if we take the Trump administration at its word, which is comes with its own caveats, but if we did and we assume that amount of corn is going to be there, you're going to need something like a 187 U.S. yield to get carry out above 2 billion. You're going to, a 180 yield would put you down at 1.1 or 1.2, and that's $5.56 plus corn. So I think you have to account for that and just, you know, don't fall asleep. Make sure you have some of your risk covered. If you're able to break out to that top side incrementally, you want to start selling up and get up probably close to our crop insurance guarantee.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with what we've been doing, just having a price floor under, just let the upside roll here. You know, there's an opportunity to raise your price floor to 480 or $5. It goes higher, keep raising it, stay open on cash sales. But a lot of the conversation's been towards crop insurance, crop revenue. I've got so-called put for the downside. Well, that's fine, but the thing is, the numbers I've seen for that to kick in, to pay off, you need to go down to 415. So if you're not worried about 70 cents down, you're okay.
I do have a question from the industry perspective about exports to China. Has the industry been chattering since that 7-10 billion number came out about corn exports? Have you heard that internally? Have they talked about it as corn? Have they talked about it as ethanol? What kind of discussions are taking place?
So it's so unknown, right? There's just a number that's been thrown out, that 17 billion, if to your point, it would get us close to that $30 billion number. And that's, I mean, that's roughly the 5-year average, right? So on some level, at that highest level, it's kind of status quo, with understanding that beans are far more valuable than corn, et cetera, et cetera. The issue with Chinese corn right now is that it is expensive. They had some trouble in the Northeast. So I think that they would probably, those processors would welcome some cheaper corn. So I do think that it's a realistic possibility. U.S. corn right now is still cheap. We're still, I think the Gulf bids are still like a dollar or two under Argentine bids. But it's I don't know if we would see necessarily anything else Ethanol, probably not likely. Distillers grains, I don't know. I think there's probably going to be more room for some of the processed products, right? So it could be beef, even though it's incredibly expensive right now, pork and so forth. But, you know, honestly, in terms of Chinese corn demand, I don't know that long term, I don't know that there's all that much opportunity. The Chinese have been making really huge investments in irrigation and other infrastructure out in kind of the Northwest, the non-traditional corn growing areas. So they're getting some pretty significant yields that I have no reason to dispute them. They're getting like Midwestern yields in kind of a, you know, really dry and arid part of China. So I don't know. I would think that if something happens, it'll be kind of a short-term year or two, but I don't know what the prospects are really, really long-term.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the logistics, but well, you got something you really want to jump in on.
Well, I guess, you know, look, to Colin's point, I mean, don't take anything away from that analysis because it's exactly precise in terms of the economic analysis of how free trade should work. I think we're probably need to recognize, or at least in my opinion, I'll just say it for myself, that we're in a situation where geopolitics and politics are trumping economics, and China doesn't need the corn. China has a lot of corn. China has a lot of supply in general. They're trying to shrink their hog herd. Hog pork prices are at 12-year lows. You know, they don't want U.S. beef. They, you know, you can go on down the list. But when you look at what's happening in the bigger, quote-unquote, bigger picture, Todd, I think you see a situation where what does China want? China wants Trump to cut the fentanyl and reciprocal tariffs that are, we'll call it 24% right now. That in terms of, you know, $500 billion of exports to the U.S. every year could save them over $60 billion annually, all right? So would you spend $17 billion on something that's overpriced and maybe you don't need in exchange to get $60 billion? I might take that deal. And, I think it leaves open, you know, like I said, the potential that this deal actually, you know, works for both sides. Now, I'm not saying it makes economic sense, but that's true of a lot of things, political. So
it is very clear from the administration, roughly speaking, maybe I'm reading more into it, but I thought it was pretty clear from the administration that the Board of Trade they expect to put in place, and we still need details about this, is about managed trade and not about free trade between the United States and China. And that's exactly what you're telling me.
Yeah. And I mean, they've said as much. Now, I mean, economics at some point have a play in the process, but right now you have two global leaders who are trying to do a very delicate dance of getting along, but also promoting their own, you know, their own ideas about how things should be and where we're at. You can throw Taiwan into that mix. You can talk about Iran. You can talk about Russia. I mean, and things that we always talk about. But I think the point is valid, Todd.
No, I think that that's absolutely right. The reality is that this is politics, right? It's really not necessarily market dynamics that might be moving it. Although I think the market will, there is a component there. The Chinese are, you know, it's a centrally planned economy, but the industry does have some say or a sway with, you know, with the government. So if they feel like they, you know, certain sectors of the economy could benefit from this, they're going to carve that out. They can make that happen. So I think that's absolutely correct. We don't know what's going to necessarily happen. I'm just personal. My personal kind of philosophy is that, you know, the free trade works, the market works, and managed trade ends up distorting all of this, right? And so I have my own personal concerns about that, I guess.
When you look at what the trend's been on billions of dollars on purchasing ag, the trend's been up. We topped out a little over $30 billion. Last couple of years, we've come down to 28, 17. This last year, $8 billion. So the stage is set for them to maybe come in and re-up that over time. However, they come in buying U.S. soybeans. That's going to take away demand from South America. If South America has a big crop, world bean value is going to be lower. So logistic-wise, we picked up bean meal from other countries that we lost from China. China buys from us. You know, it's a world balance sheet you got to look at. So you got to be cautious on big bullish news.
I think it will be interesting to see, because we know rather than a dollar value for the soybeans, at least for the remaining 3 years of the president's term in office, and Jameson Greer said that on Face the Nation, so I'm thinking about the 25 million metric tons as calendar years as opposed to anything else related to a marketing year. Through those 3 years, this one, the next one, and the following one, they're going to buy 25 million metric tons, but at what value is the question? And does that get thrown into the Board of Trade in some form? Not for the $18 billion, but do they set a price somehow?
Well, I mean, certainly you could see a manipulation is the wrong word, but a way of putting a floor underneath those beans, knowing that China has to come for those beans. And, you know, to the points that have been talked about, China's savvy. They don't want to buy overpriced beans. They don't want to do different things. Keep in mind today, they still have either a 10 to a 15% import tariff on U.S. ag products. So corn, beans, wheat, Milo, whatever you want to talk about. So in that sense, Todd, yeah, I mean, it's certainly, the market is always forward looking and anticipating. If they feel that demand is going to be there, they're going to price that into futures. And, you know, we go back to the point that we just circle back to the point that we just talked about. I don't think there's any better evidence of the politics at work here in this type of a situation than China just bought 12 million metric tons of beans, you know, that were $1 to $2 a bushel more expensive than what they could have originated out of South America. And they did it for a political purpose. And that was the first fentanyl, the 5% cut in the fentanyl tariffs, right, during the October meeting. So there's precedent for that. And, you know, the trading community and the Board of Trade price is going to account for that.
Go on.
You got to look long term. This all started the Trump administration, but Trump's days are starting to be numbered here. So you see a change in political leadership in Washington. Is it still going to be enforced? Is it still going to be talked about? So this is where the geopolitical risk comes in for quite some time, when you just don't know who's going to be doing what.
Recalling the phase one trade agreement, which never was fulfilled.
Yeah, that's basically it. I know there's a lot of folks that were pretty disappointed in that it didn't really continue. But with a lot of these deals, they're more or less handshake agreements, right? And so if there's no teeth in the agreement, then either party could just walk away, right? And that's kind of what happened. Obviously, COVID was a curveball that nobody saw coming, and that screwed things up too. So, but no, I guess that kind of gets back to my point is, when we pursue kind of this managed trade or buying targets and so forth, it is divorced from the market reality, and it ends up, I think, causing a lot more risk in the long run, right? There, you might be able to kind of buoy prices for a little bit, but if the market isn't allowed to react the way that it wants to, or that it should, that has a much longer tail, I guess.
To this point, phase one at least was written down and signed. But to this point, these are handshake deals. There are no written parameters set around them, and that sounds risky.
Well, yeah, this whole thing is risky. It's put together on a hope and a prayer, a little bit of duct tape and a little bit of baling wire. And to Kurt's point, when Trump has to leave office, we have a whole, you know, potentially a whole new, you know, playing field on our situation. In the meantime, in the next 2 years, this is what we've got to work. This is the sandbox that we're going to play in, right? And, you know, I wouldn't expect China to come out in any way, shape, or form and confirm or, you know, verbally or document that this $17 billion is going to be, you know, is going to be fulfilled. It works against their commercial interest as a buyer of grain, right, and trying to buy it as cheap as they can. I think the sign that you want to look for, Todd, is that if to me, what's on the bargaining table right now between the U.S. and China, or Trump and Xi more specifically, is you lower the fentanyl or reciprocal tariffs, we'll lower our import tariffs on grain. You get the grain exports you want, we get to export the widgets and TVs and every other thing that we can think of on our terms and at a lower price. And that's what we're looking for. So if you see any movement by the Chinese government that starts to lower these current import tariffs to the private buyers, it's a sign that we're moving in that direction. Whether they eliminate it, whether they take it back to the 3% that's been normal, whether they reduce it from 15 to 10, the market and the trade is pausing here, I think, to look for or wait for that type of a signal.
That include the $5 and the $12 related to new crop corn and soybeans?
For sure, yeah. I think so.
Yeah, most definitely those were benchmarks talked about for quite some time. But $12 beans, it's getting kind of interesting up here short term. We're kind of carving out a little bit of a head and shoulders top, which technically is a little bit risky here. But if you look at the big picture and step back, there's a pretty good sized bull pennant here. So if we could get something to go. And don't count it out, because beans have climbed the wall of worry since last fall. And the producer right now goes, man, why did I sell all those beans off the combine last fall? Well, it was a money management decision. And as long as you replacement, it's you're still in the game in through here. But when you look at the growing season in front of us, there's going to be a lot of volatility as we move forward.
I know that you're in the corn industry, but I do want to talk about renewable diesel, SAF, and how all of those are related, because sustainable aviation fuel can be made from either ethanol and or soybean oil. Part of the reason soybeans have been climbing is the idea that renewable diesel is going to be really pushing that along. How does that impact the market for sustainable or renewable fuels in general?
Well, so I think one of the big movers right now, or one of the reasons that the bean market has been supported, is the renewable volume obligation announcement, right? So yes, renewable diesel is a component there. Sustainable aviation fuel, probably less so. Sustainable aviation fuel is, I think, longer term is definitely a market. In my mind, an ethanol to jet pathway is 5-10, maybe even longer, 5-10 years out. Demand for renewable fuels, I suspect, will keep growing, and that will put a floor under, corn and beans. I think that you might actually even, have some, this really high price used cooking oil and, fats and stuff like that, that have a knock-on effect. Honestly, in the nearest term, I would say that maritime renewable fuels is probably something that is maybe a little bit more realistic than sustainable aviation fuel, because those vessels that are basically running on bunker fuel or heavy fuel oil, all of those lines, especially the container lines, they're really looking to reduce their carbon intensity so that they can tell all of their consumer good folks that they're being good stewards, right? So you've seen companies like Maersk running ethanol vessels, and I think that's fairly realistic in the nearer term. So in 5 years, you're probably going to see some more demand there, but there's a whole lot of other challenges that go along with that, just the logistics of getting fuel ethanol to a port and being able to fuel vessels that are capable of running ethanol. A vessel that's built to run on fuel oil or a bunker fuel is not designed to run on ethanol. So there's a whole lot of dynamics, I guess, in the renewable fuel space.
Maersk did, by chance this week, announce that it had managed to complete a route running ethanol in that particular ship. So it is something that can come forward. On that note, as it's related to the RVOs, and the cooking oil that could come in from China and other places, how much of an impact do you think that might have on the upward mobility of the price of soybeans and What I think that the marketplace, farmers in particular, see as a really big shot in the arm near term, because it's not until sometime in 27 or 28 that those RVOs really come into play, keeping that kind of used cooking oil out of the United States.
Yeah, Todd, I mean, certainly it's a supportive factor in terms of the price that we're at. I guess what concerns me in terms of the upside potential that we have from here is that with crush margins where they're at, whether it's traditional soybean crush margins or whether it's, you know, biodiesel crush margins, they couldn't really be even any better. Call it $2.50, $3 a bushel in some cases. So every plant out there is running effectively as much as they possibly can, or at capacity or over nameplate capacity at this particular point, to try and take advantage of that economically. There is additional capacity coming online, but it doesn't come overnight. And a lot of that got stalled out to a degree as we waited for this biofuels regulations to kind of unfold and finally, you know, be released. So it helps long term. It certainly helps us adjust our mix to a more domestic usage of the soybeans that we produce as opposed to the export market. That's been important, but you know, the trifecta for us, or the ultimate for us as producers and as farmers and grain marketers, is to have both of those elements and have a very, you know, solid and strong demand base. So the biodiesel is certainly doing its part for the domestic side. We're gonna have to wait on China and politics and see how the export side turns out.
Yeah, when you look at the supply-demand balance sheet for soybeans, 310 million bushel carryout, well, if you take yield down one bushel, where your bean harvested acres are, over 80 million, you're going to have a very tight supply-demand balance sheet down to 200, close to 200 million bushel. But the bear's going to say demand's overrated by 100 million bushels. So we need China. We need this renewable fuels, bean oil, to make sure that supply-demand balance sheet stays solid and tight. Plus, too, there's some worry about oil, peanut oil, cooking. Delta's getting some rain, so we'll have some peanut oil.
Let's take time now to wrap up our conversation. We'll get a final word from each of you. We'll start with Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing.
Yeah, I mean, Todd, good to be with you guys today. And in the locale of Farmer City, it's always great to be in some of these local areas in central Illinois. So appreciative of that. I think I'm the guy on this program who's been saying, you know, play defensively when it comes to marketing. I think you have to recognize a shift when it comes along. And I've shifted my mentality because of the potential for the China additional buying of U.S. ag products. So I think you want to be more opportunistic in your thinking right now. I think you want to look to maximize profit, for lack of a better term, as opposed to defending break-evens, and let this thing play out just a little bit. I think we bought ourselves some time to do that. Now, having said that, one stroke of the pen, one headline can change it all and put it on its ear. So we have to remain flexible here. Certainly have some of an appropriate amount of your farm's risk covered or locked up. And to Kurt's point, whether that's with cash sales, whether that's with positions on the board, whether it's options, whether it's, you know, any tool that you choose to use, make sure you get yourself to that level where you're comfortable and you got some sleep quotient. Even if we're 50% sold here and the market goes $1, $2, $3 higher, we got 50% more to sell, and it's going to be a great year. So more optimism, I think, than what we've had here of late.
Our thanks, of course, do go to Good Spirits in Farmer City for hosting us, and to you as well, Kurt Kimmel, for driving in from Normal to do the program. What's your final word for the day?
No, I think Dave did a great job of kind of summing it up there. I mean, he's to the point. He kind of laid out what we got to watch for. I know each individual is different. Each individual has a different comfort zone, so it's a matter of just getting hooked up with somebody, sitting down, pushing the pencil, and leave your options open.
And finally, we'll turn our attention at the end of the program, and thank you so much, Colin Waters, for bringing your viewpoints from the Illinois corn growers and the broader political perspective to us today as well, coming in from Normal. What's your final word?
Well, I guess I'm really hopeful that that we're going to see a strong market this year. I'm watching Brazil right now. That Safrinha crop will be coming off here soon, and we'll have to see how that affects things. I'm not going to wish any ill, bad weather or anything like that on those guys, but better them than us. And then I guess the only other thing is kind of on the weather side too, is just on the logistics. So barge traffic has been okay, but the river system is a little bit low. So, you know, recent rains have been helpful, but there's still quite a bit of drought out west and on the Ohio Valley too. So hopefully we'll have a good crop and we'll be able to get it to market.
You've been listening, of course, to Commodity Week from Illinois Public Media. You may hear the whole of the program anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org on demand, or look it up by name, Commodity Week, in your favorite podcast applications. Our thanks go to our panelists today, including Kurt Kimmel, Colin Waters, and Dave Chatterton. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.